You know that moment, right? That little bit of confusion when a perfectly polite email seems to land like a diplomatic incident.
Oh, yeah. Or maybe you get a chat message from a younger colleague and it's just full of abbreviations. You're left scratching your head.
Exactly. These aren't just, personal quirks. They're often subtle clues that different communication wavelengths are at play. And in today's world, it's so interconnected. Whether you're brainstorming with someone in Tokyo or maybe just a Gen Z intern a few desks away, bridging these communication gaps isn't just about being polite anymore. It's really about unlocking truly inclusive and, well, productive collaboration.
It really is. And it's fascinating how quickly those awkward moments, those little hiccups, can actually transform into genuine connection. Once you understand a few key frameworks, anyway.
So for this deep dive, we've really dug into some great source material, a whole chapter focused on communicating across cultures and generations. Lots of practical stuff in there.
Yeah, some really insightful pieces.
Our mission today, basically, cut through the noise, give you those essential aha moments, a clear shortcut, if you will, to being well informed on this vital topic.
We want to help you sidestep those cultural missteps, maybe embrace the different generational strengths you see.
And really turn diversity into your team's superpower. So let's jump in.
Let's do it.
Okay, so to really unpack this, I think we have to start with a foundational tool, Geert Hosteed's Dimensions of Culture. Can you kind of set the stage for us? What makes this model so, well, powerful for navigating cross-cultural communication?
Absolutely. Hofstede's model, it gives us six key dimensions. Think of them like a universal translator almost. They help us understand the unspoken rules of communication across different cultures.
Okay.
And mastering them, it isn't just about avoiding offense, though that's important. It's really about building trust, improving collaboration, and fostering a truly inclusive environment. They're like cultural blueprints.
Blueprints. I like that metaphor. Okay, so let's start with the first one. Power distance. What does that tell us about how people interact with, say, authority?
Power distance. It measures how much a society accepts and even expects hierarchy, unequal distribution of power.
Okay.
So in high power distance cultures, think maybe China or Mexico, there's a strong, often unspoken respect for authority figures. Communication tends to flow downwards more easily than upwards. And challenging a leader directly, especially in a group, that might be seen as pretty disrespectful.
So you'd use formal titles, things like that.
Definitely. Formality is expected. And here's a hidden truth. Silence from a junior colleague in such a setting might not mean they agree. It could just mean they're not comfortable speaking up directly to power.
That's a really crucial point. And conversely, what about low power distance cultures like the US or Sweden?
In those places, hierarchies tend to be much flatter. People are generally comfortable, sometimes even expected, to openly share ideas, debate things, even with their managers.
So direct feedback isn't seen as confrontational.
Often, no. It frequently seen as a sign of engagement, of being invested.
Okay, that makes sense. So blueprint number two.
That would be individualism versus collectivism. This one's about whether people are focused more on me or we.
Right. Individual goals versus group harmony.
Exactly. In individualistic cultures like the USA or Australia, the emphasis is usually on personal achievements, individual rights. Communication is often direct, very task-oriented. Feedback is usually given one-on-one.
Okay. And collectivist cultures. You mentioned Japan, India.
In those cultures, it's often all about group harmony, maintaining relationships. Communication tends to be more indirect, polite, diplomatic, especially when it comes to criticism.
So you wouldn't just say that's wrong.
Probably not directly, no. You'd likely frame feedback very gently, maybe suggest alternatives, perhaps even use a third party sometimes, or just be very soft and suggestive. Preserving face for everyone involved is really important.
A subtle difference, but yeah, a powerful one. Okay, next dimension.
Next up is masculinity versus femininity. Now, these names can be a bit misleading. It's really about societal values, not necessarily gender roles in the traditional sense.
Ah, okay, so what values are we talking about?
Masculine cultures, like, say, Japan or Germany, tend to value assertiveness, competitiveness, ambition, performance. Communication is often quite direct, focusing on outcomes, results, achievements.
Makes sense. And feminine cultures, like Sweden or Norway.
They tend to prioritize collaboration, consensus, quality of life, empathy. Communication is usually more inclusive, focusing on team input, group decision making. You'd emphasize shared goals, mutual support, that kind of thing.
Okay, dimension number four.
That's uncertainty avoidance. This measures how comfortable a society is with ambiguity, with the unknown.
Okay, so some cultures like surprises, others not so much.
Kind of. High uncertainty avoidance cultures, France, Greece, for example, tend to crave clarity, rules, structure. They prefer detailed, explicit instructions. Why? Because ambiguity makes them uncomfortable. They like to know what's going to happen.
So for them, you'd want to provide a really comprehensive step-by-step plan, clear expectations.
Exactly. But in a low uncertainty avoidance cultures like the USA or Singapore, there's generally much more comfort with ambiguity. Fewer detailed instructions might be needed. People are often more flexible, adaptable.
So you could offer general guidance and trust them to figure out the specifics more.
Precisely. They're often more comfortable with risk and less rigid planning.
Right. What's next on the list?
The next one is long-term versus short-term orientation. This reveals a culture's perspective on time and tradition versus, well, immediate gratification.
Future focus versus present focus.
Sort of. Long-term oriented cultures like China or Japan tend to stress virtues like patience, perseverance, thrift, building strong relationships, and focusing on future rewards. Decision-making might be slower, more consensus-driven, because they're thinking decades ahead.
Which means if you're working with them, you need to appreciate those thoughtful, relationship-based discussions, even if they take a bit more time.
Absolutely. Rushing things might not work well. Now, for short-term cultures, like the USA or Australia, the focus is often on immediate results, quick decisions, meeting quarterly goals. Communication tends to be faster, more direct. Tradition is less of a constraint.
Think quarterly earnings reports versus, say, decade-long strategic partnerships.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, one dimension left.
The last one is indulgence versus restraint. This explores how freely societies allow gratification of basic human drives related to enjoying life and having fun.
So how openly people express emotions and enjoy themselves?
Essentially, yes. In indulgent cultures like Brazil or Mexico, people are typically quite open, expressive, maybe more optimistic and enthusiastic in their communication. Informal, social interactions are important for strengthening bonds.
Okay. Lots of smiles, maybe more physical contact, that sort of thing.
Could be, yeah. But in restrained cultures, Russia or China might be examples, communication tends to be more controlled, reserved, and formal. There's a stronger emphasis on maintaining professionalism, adhering to social norms.
So building trust might involve showing composure, controlled emotional expression.
Exactly. Open displays of emotion might be seen as less professional in some contexts.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot to keep in mind. It's one thing to, you know, understand these dimensions intellectually.
Right.
But the real trick is knowing how to deploy that knowledge. Like, in the moment, how can our listeners quickly apply this, say, before an important international call or meeting?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's about pausing and thinking. Before you even draft that email or jump on that video call, just ask yourself a few things. Like, am I showing the right amount of respect for hierarchy here? Is my message geared towards the individual or the group? Am I emphasizing cooperation enough? Or should I focus more on competition? Am I giving the right level of detail? Or maybe too much? Or not enough? Am I aligning with their expectations around time, immediate results versus long-term view? And importantly, how should I express myself emotionally? Should I be more reserved or more expressive?
That's a great checklist. It forces you to be intentional.
Let's make it even more practical. Imagine you're leading a global project. You've got team members from Germany, Japan, and Brazil. How would you adapt?
Okay. Based on what we just discussed, Germany, likely low power distance, high uncertainty avoidance, Japan, high power distance, long-term oriented, Brazil, maybe higher indulgence, perhaps lower uncertainty avoidance too.
Right. So.
So I'd tailor everything. For my German colleagues, I'd probably offer very clear, detailed plans. I'd expect and welcome direct questions.
Good.
With the Japanese team members, I'd make sure I'm showing appropriate respect for hierarchy. Maybe start meetings with more relationship-building chat. I'd understand that decisions might take a bit longer, need more consensus because of that long-term view.
Excellent. And Brazil?
For the Brazilian team, I'd probably find more open, expressive communication works well. Maybe embrace a bit more informality to build those bonds. Be flexible if things don't stick strictly to the plan.
Perfect. Saying that informed approach isn't just, you know, nice to have. It fundamentally changes the dynamic and boosts your chances of success.
Definitely. Okay, let's pivot slightly. Have you ever sent maybe what you thought was a straightforward direct email?
Uh-oh.
And it was perceived as, well, rude. Or maybe you completely missed a subtle hint from an overseas colleague.
Happens all the time. And those moments often boil down to a different but related dynamic, high context versus low context communication styles.
Okay, high context, low context. Tell us more.
Sure. This concept, it comes from anthropologist Edward T. Hall. It basically explains the unspoken rules of how explicitly information needs to be shared.
So how much you spell things out versus how much is just understood.
Exactly. It's about how much you rely on the explicit words versus the shared understanding, the nonverbal cues, the whole situation surrounding the communication. Misunderstanding this can lead to massive communication breakdowns. It really can.
Okay, break it down for us. High context communication.
Yep. In high context communication, people communicate more indirectly, subtly. There's a heavy reliance on implicit meanings. Listeners are expected to understand based on the context, the relationship, tone of voice, body language, social cues, even shared history.
Which cultures tend to be high context?
You often see this in places like Japan, China, Korea, India, many Middle Eastern and Latin American cultures as well.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, a classic one from Japan. Someone might say, yes, hi. But often it doesn't mean, yes, I agree with you. It might just mean, yes, I hear you, or I understand what you're saying.
So agreement might be shown differently.
Much more subtly. Maybe through hesitation or a lack of objection or even just polite silence or a slight deflection. The underlying message, the feeling, is often more critical than the literal words. You have to read the air, as they say.
Fascinating how one word can carry such different weight. Okay, flip side, low context communication.
Low context is the opposite. People prefer communication to be direct, explicit, clear. Messages are fully spelled out in words. Meaning doesn't rely heavily on shared background or unspoken context.
And typical cultures here.
Think USA, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, Australia, Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
Places where say what you mean and mean what you say is often the default expectation.
Right. So an email saying, I disagree with point number 3 in your proposal and here's why, would be perfectly normal.
Exactly. In Germany or the US, that's generally seen as professional, constructive feedback. There's usually no need to read between the lines. The message is the message.
So the key difference is how much the context around the words matters versus the words themselves.
Precisely. High context values subtlety, indirectness, saving face, building relationships first. Decision making might be slower, more about consensus. Low context values directness, clarity, efficiency. Decisions might be faster, more task focused.
Okay, so if you're navigating these different styles, how does this translate into actionable communication advice for our listeners? What should they do?
Great question. If you're dealing with high context cultures, you really need to prioritize relationship building. Spend time getting to know people. Pay super close attention to nonverbal cues, tone, pauses, body language. And listen for what isn't being said.
And avoid blunt language.
Definitely. Instead of saying your work isn't satisfactory, a higher context approach might be something like, could we perhaps review some areas together? Maybe explore some alternative approaches. The focus is on collaborative improvement, not direct critique.
That makes a huge difference in tone.
Okay.
And for navigating low context cultures.
Be explicit. Be direct. Articulate your message clearly. Provide all the necessary details up front. Don't assume anything is understood if it hasn't been stated.
So you'd clearly say, please submit your draft by Tuesday morning, focusing on sections 1, 3, and 5. No ambiguity.
Exactly. No room for misinterpretation. The ultimate goal, really, is to become adaptable, to consciously adjust your style depending on who you're talking to.
So if you finish a meeting with your Japanese colleagues.
High context.
And then immediately jump on a conference call with your German team.
Low context.
You need to consciously switch gears. From subtle suggestions, maybe, to very direct statements and questions.
You got it. Imagine that team. Again, someone from Japan, someone from the U.S. You might politely ask the Japanese member, would you perhaps mind exploring a different approach if you feel it might be beneficial?
Very gentle.
Right. Whereas you might directly tell the U.S. member, okay, let's revise this. Please use these specific points I'm sending over and get it back to me by Friday. It's about meeting people where they are comfortable.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, let's switch gears a bit now. Let's talk generations. Ever wonder why, say, an older coworker meticulously crafts these long, detailed emails, while a younger colleague just zaps off these quick chat messages full of things like BRB or TLDR?
Huh. Yes. Those are classic generational differences playing out right there in your inbox or chat window. It's a real thing.
So today's workplaces, they often span multiple generations, right?
Absolutely. It's common to have baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, or Gen Y, and now Gen Z all working together. Each group brings unique communication preferences, often shaped by the technology and norms of the era they grew up in.
And recognizing these isn't about stereotyping, is it?
Not at all. It's about understanding general tendencies and expectations to improve collaboration, minimize misunderstandings, and honestly, just boost productivity. It helps you connect better.
Okay, can you walk us through the typical communication traits for each generation? Maybe touch on a common misconception too.
Sure. Let's start with baby boomers, born roughly 1946 to 1964. They often prefer more formal, structured communication. Face-to-face meetings or phone calls are often valued.
An email.
Yes, often well-organized, comprehensive emails. A common misconception might be that they're completely tech-averse. Many are very proficient. They just might prefer channels that allow for more formality or detail compared to instant messaging. A boomer manager, for instance, often really appreciates regular status meetings with clear agendas.
Okay. Then we have Generation X, born about 1965 to 1980. The middle child generation, sometimes called.
Yeah. Gen Xers are often seen as adaptable pragmatists. They kind of bridge the traditional and the modern. They generally prefer communication to be clear, concise, practical, no nonsense.
Efficiency is key.
Very often, yes. A Gen X team leader probably wants a concise, well-organized email clearly outlining tasks and timelines. They value direct feedback without excessive fluff. They're usually comfortable across different channels, but prioritize whatever gets the job done efficiently.
Right. Next up, millennials, or Gen Y, born roughly 1981 to 1996. The first generation to really grow up with the internet readily available.
Right. And that shapes their preferences. They often prefer quick, informal, and highly collaborative communication. They leverage digital channels, heavily think Slack, Teams, share documents. Social media style interactions feel natural.
So quick replies via chat, maybe using emojis or GIFs.
Yeah, that's common. A misconception. Maybe that they only want informal communication. They value responsiveness and collaboration, often blending channels as needed. They just expect things to move faster.
Got it. And finally, Generation Z, born around 1997 to 2012. True digital natives.
Absolutely. They've grown up immersed in a digital world. They expect communication to be instant, visually engaging, highly interactive. Brevity is often prized.
Visual content is big for them.
Huge. Short videos, infographics, quick updates via messaging apps, rapid responses are almost baseline expectation. That TLDR too long, didn't read, is practically a native tongue for some.
Huh. It's a quick way to say, give me the bottom line fast.
Exactly. They process information incredibly quickly, often visually.
So this brings up a great point about practical application. If you're leading a project team and you've got people from all these generations, how do you actually tailor your communication so everyone feels included and, you know, gets the message effectively?
The absolute key is flexibility and understanding, and maybe even just asking people what they prefer.
Radical idea.
But seriously, for your boomer colleagues, maybe schedule those regular face-to-face check-ins or send detailed structured emails. For Gen X, keep emails brief, practical, focus on the essentials. Direct messages outlining tasks work well too.
Okay, millennials.
They'll likely appreciate informal updates on Slack or Teams, maybe using shared documents for real-time collaboration. Encourage that back and forth.
And Gen Z.
Think short, engaging visual summaries, quick instant messages for updates, maybe even short videos instead of long emails sometimes. Keep it snappy, keep it visual where possible.
So it's really about blending methods, isn't it? And setting clear expectations up front.
Absolutely. You might explicitly say at the start of a project, okay, team, let's use email for formal updates and final documents, but let's use Slack for quick questions and ongoing discussion. That way, everyone knows the rules of engagement.
That clarity helps everyone. Okay, let's think about the bigger picture again. Have you ever been in a global meeting and felt uncertain about the message? Or perhaps sensed that certain perspectives were maybe inadvertently ignored?
Definitely. It happens. And effective communication today, especially globally, is truly about making sure everyone feels valued, feels heard, and feels respected, regardless of their cultural background or generation.
Yeah, not just a nice to have.
Not at all. Inclusive global communication isn't just a buzzword. It's the absolute foundation for reducing misunderstandings, building deep trust, and fostering strong relationships across all these divides, cultural, generational, you name it.
And the payoff.
More respectful work environments, for one, but also genuinely enhanced productivity and a real surge in creativity and innovation. When people feel safe to contribute, you get better ideas.
So what are the really actionable strategies? How do we build that truly inclusive communication environment? Let's maybe dive into, say, 6 key approaches.
Okay. First, and this is ongoing, cultivate cultural awareness and sensitivity. This means continuously learning, staying curious, building your understanding.
So not just a one-time training.
No way. For instance, before a global call, just take 5 minutes. Do a quick search on the basic communication customs or potential sensitivities of the participants' cultures. A common pitfall here is just assuming your own cultural default way of communicating is universal. It rarely is.
Good point. Okay, strategy number 2.
Use clear, accessible language. Simplicity and clarity are your absolute best friends in diverse settings. Actively avoid jargon, slang, complex idioms, or acronyms that might not translate well or be understood by everyone.
Can you give an example of simplifying?
Sure. Instead of saying something like, let's circle back later to drill down into the granular details of this synergistic initiative.
Okay, yeah, that's a mouthful.
Right. You could just say, let's revisit this topic later and examine the specific details of this project closely. Make your meaning unmistakable. Clear is kind.
Clear is kind. I like that. Okay, third strategy.
Third, and this is so crucial, actively listen and encourage participation. Make sure everyone truly has an equal opportunity to speak. Pay special attention to folks from cultures where jumping into the conversation might be less common or where interrupting is considered rude.
How do you do that actively?
You can specifically invite quieter members. In a global call, maybe say something like, look, we haven't heard your perspective on this yet. What are your thoughts? Or Maria, anything you'd like to add? This explicitly signals their input is valued and expected.
Nice. Okay, number 4.
Leverage multiple communication channels. Don't just rely on one method, like only email or only meetings. Adapt your methods to suit diverse preferences and learning styles.
So after a meeting.
Exactly. Maybe send a concise email summary, share the presentation slides, perhaps even post a short visual infographic highlighting the key decisions on your team's platform. Different people absorb and retain information in different ways. Give them options.
Makes sense. 5th strategy.
Be mindful of time zones and schedules. This seems basic, but it demonstrates genuine respect for people's lives outside of work, instead of always scheduling meetings at a time that's only convenient for your time zone.
Which happens a lot.
It does. Try to rotate meeting times, sharing the inconvenience more equally among the team. And always, always clearly express gratitude when people are joining calls very early or very late their time. A simple, thanks so much for joining at this hour, goes a long way.
Absolutely. Okay, and the final strategy, number 6.
Provide and participate in cross-cultural and generational training. This isn't just an HR thing. It actively boosts the cultural intelligence and understanding across the entire team or organization.
What could that look like?
It could be formal workshops or even informal lunch and learns where team members share insights about their own cultural customs or communication preferences. Making it a two-way street of learning is really powerful.
So connecting this back to that global team example, Germany, India, Brazil.
Right. You'd put these strategies into action. You'd research their communication preferences beforehand. You'd use clear, jargon-free language in discussions. You'd make a point to invite each member's input by name. You'd follow up meetings with summaries via both email and maybe some visuals. You'd consciously rotate meeting times. And you'd advocate for or participate in regular cross-cultural sharing or training sessions. It becomes a holistic approach.
Got it. Now let's talk about something maybe a little more sensitive. We've probably all been there.
Yeah.
Maybe unintentionally causing some discomfort or witnessing a casual remark just create tension.
Yeah. Those moments often stem from subtle cultural missteps, maybe unconscious bias or things called microaggressions.
And even when they're totally unintentional, these missteps can really damage workplace relationships, hurt morale, and drag down productivity, can't they?
They absolutely can. Proactively understanding and avoiding them is just paramount. If you want to create an environment that's genuinely inclusive, psychologically safe, and truly respectful, it's where trust is built or broken.
So let's get really clear on the terms. Can we define these maybe with specific practical examples? First up, cultural missteps.
Okay. A cultural misstep is basically an action or statement that unintentionally disrespects or disregards someone's cultural background or practices.
Example.
A common one is making assumptions about holidays, like assuming everyone celebrates Christmas or Easter. A more thoughtful alternative is to ask neutrally, "Do you have any plans for the upcoming break?" Or, "Are you taking any time off around the holidays?"
Okay, makes sense. Next term, bias. This can be conscious or unconscious, right?
Exactly. Bias refers to those preconceived ideas or stereotypes that unfairly influence our perceptions, judgments, or actions towards others. Unconscious bias is particularly tricky because we're often unaware we hold it.
What's a common workplace example?
A very common one relates to age and technology. Assuming younger colleagues are automatically tech wizards, or conversely, assuming older colleagues will inevitably struggle with new software.
So instead of assuming...
Just ask. Are you familiar with this platform, or should we walk through it together? Treat everyone as an individual.
Right. And the third term, microaggressions. These sound small, but they can have a big impact.
They really can. Microaggressions are subtle, often unintentional, everyday comments or actions that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative attitudes toward culturally marginalized groups. They're like little paper cuts. One might not seem like a big deal, but they add up.
Can you give an example?
A very common one, often said with seemingly good intentions, is telling someone from a different ethnic background, "Wow, you speak English really well."
Why is that problematic? It sounds like a compliment.
It sounds like one, but the underlying message it often sends is one of surprise. It implies that it's unusual for someone who looks like them to speak English well, subtly questioning their belonging, their intelligence, or their nativeness. It singles them out.
Ah, okay. It's about that implied message, the subtext. So knowing what these are is the first step.
Yeah.
What are the concrete, actionable steps we can all take to avoid these pitfalls? How do we foster that truly inclusive environment?
Great question. There are several key things. First, and maybe most importantly, educate yourself continuously. This isn't a one-and-done thing. Attend workshops, read books and articles from diverse perspectives, listen to podcasts like this one, seek out different viewpoints.
So be a lifelong learner about diversity and inclusion.
Exactly. Participate in any company-sponsored diversity training. Join employee resource groups. Follow diverse voices online. It's an ongoing journey.
Okay, what's another practical step?
Second, pause before you speak or type. Cultivate that habit of self-awareness. Just take a brief moment, maybe half a second, to reflect on the potential impact of your words before they come out.
Think twice. Speak once.
Pretty much. For example, instead of blurting out, "Where are you really from?" If someone have an accent or a name you don't recognize, pause. Maybe just ask, "Where did you grow up?" Or let them share what they're comfortable sharing. It's a small shift, but it avoids making someone feel like an outsider.
That's a great, simple reframe. Okay, third step.
Actively avoid assumptions and stereotypes. Constantly challenge your own generalizations. Make a conscious effort to see and treat people as individuals, not as representatives of a group.
So don't assume someone's background dictates their skills or interests.
Right. Instead of thinking, "Oh, they're from culture X, they must be good at Y," just ask directly, "What are your strengths?" Or, "What parts of this project interest you most?" Let people define themselves.
Good advice. Fourth step.
Practice inclusive, respectful language. This means being mindful of the words you choose. Use gender-neutral terms whenever possible. Folks, everyone, team, instead of guys. Avoid cultural idioms or slang that might exclude or confuse people. And always make an effort to use people's preferred names and pronouns correctly.
And if you're unsure about pronunciation...
Just ask politely. People usually appreciate the effort.
Okay. Fifth step. What if we mess up? Because we probably will sometime.
We absolutely will. We're human. So the fifth step is respond thoughtfully to mistakes. If you mispronounce a name, use the wrong pronoun, or accidentally say something insensitive, don't get defensive or make excuses. Apologize sincerely, briefly acknowledge the mistake, correct yourself, and move on. Learn from it.
So focus on the impact, not your intent.
Exactly. A quick, oh, my apologies. Thanks for correcting me. It's pronounced correct pronunciation, right? It shows humility and respect. It goes a long way towards rebuilding trust.
Okay. And a final step.
Finally, encourage open dialogue and feedback. Actively foster a safe environment where people feel comfortable pointing out potential missteps or giving feedback without fear of repercussion.
How can you signal that?
You can explicitly invite it. Regularly saying things like, "I'm always learning, so please feel free to let me know if I inadvertently say something that feels insensitive or off," can really help open that door. It shows you're committed to getting it right.
So tying this all back to leading that diverse global team meeting.
Right. It means doing your homework beforehand, reviewing potential cultural sensitivities. During the meeting, it means pausing before speaking, consciously using inclusive language like, "Hello, team." If someone gently corrects your pronunciation, you respond graciously. Thanks, I appreciate that. And maybe at the end, you explicitly say, "I welcome any feedback on how we can make these meetings even more inclusive."
It's that thoughtful, continuous approach. It's not just about avoiding pitfalls. It actively builds the trust you need for real collaboration.
That's the goal.
Okay, let's try and bring all this home. We've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, haven't we?
We certainly have.
From really getting into Hostede's cultural dimensions to distinguishing between those high and low context communication styles.
Mm-hmm. Exploring the unique communication preferences of different generations.
And we've given you some really powerful, practical strategies for truly inclusive global communication.
And crucially, hopefully armed you with some insights and tools to better navigate and avoid those cultural missteps, those hidden biases, and those painful microaggressions.
So this raises that final important question. Why does all this matter so profoundly? Why invest the effort?
Because these skills, they aren't optional extras anymore. They are absolutely fundamental to success in today's interconnected, global, and diverse workplaces. Mastering them doesn't just make you, you know, a nicer communicator.
Right. It's more than that.
Much more. It fosters deeper trust between people. It brings much needed clarity to complex interactions. It demonstrably boosts productivity and innovation. And maybe most importantly, it cultivates genuine respect. It helps ensure that every single person you work with feels truly included, valued, and heard.
So you listening right now, you've now got this powerful practical toolkit, ideas to help you navigate the complexities of global and intergenerational communication.
But the real magic, as always, happens when you move beyond just understanding these concepts intellectually and start making them an ingrained part of how you actually connect with everyone around you every single day in every interaction.
So the final thought for you to take away is this: how will you apply just one insight from today, maybe starting tomorrow, to turn a potential communication misstep into a genuine moment of true connection and understanding?